So our next speaker is Jürg Teschner from Hamburg, who is going to talk about the Sinch-Gordon model as a warm-up for the non-compact group sigma models.
Okay, yeah, thanks very much, and thanks very much to the organizers for inviting me to give the talk here. So I'll start with some introduction, which will be some sort of very panoramic and very personal view on the problem of quantizing sigma models for ADS spaces as a motivation why in this conference or in this context it might be worthwhile looking at Sinch-Gordon model. And then I want to talk about some of the peculiarities which arise there, and I want to explain that indeed some features which you see there are quite different from the previous experience that one has gathered in integrable models like Sinch-Gordon and so on and so forth. So there are some important new qualitative features which I believe are very probable also to appear in the context of sigma models for ADS spaces, simply for the fact that they are non-compact, sigma models with non-compact target spaces. Okay, so let's start with this panoramic overview. Okay, so for many of us here, sort of one ultimate goal would be to understand the string theory on ADS spaces, and there are two particularly popular or interesting examples. One is ADS3, the other is ADS5, and there have been formulations on the classical or Lagrangian level for string theory on such ADS spaces in terms of sigma models associated to supergroups or posets thereof, and just means to give names to those, there is the PSL 1,1/2 sigma model, a supersymmetric sigma model which is supposed to describe string theory on ADS3 cross S3, possibly in the presence of Ramon backgrounds. And there is the PSL 2,2/4 sigma model, which is supposed to be relevant for ADS5 cross S5. So clearly, solving the sigma models or quantizing the sigma models is going to be interesting and important for the study of string theory on these spaces. So let's for the moment focus on the simpler of those, namely PSL 1,1/2 for ADS3. And okay, often it is convenient to consider the corresponding Euclidean version, pretending that in the end of the day one can rotate, well, scattering amplitudes and so on back to the correct Lorentzian signature. And just the general structure of the sigma model action is okay, you have some sigma model term with some coupling 1 over lambda squared in front of it, which okay, as we're dealing with a supergroup, it's defined by, well, current trace, super trace taken over product of these currents, so that's a relatively standard term. And then there's the Wessimino term. And so we have these two coupling constants in the game. So in principle, here we're talking about a theory which has two coupling constants that we can play with. In this particular model, there exists also, well, at least there, of course, in many other cases as well, there exists a particular ratio between these two coupling constants, which in this case in suitable normalizations would be lambda squared equals 4 pi over k, which furthermore corresponds just to the vanishing of the Ramon background, where one has enlarged chiral symmetry of the theory, which on the Lagrangian level is manifested in the decomposition of the action as some action for the H3 WZW model, so the WZW model for the hyperbolic free space, a SU2 WZW model, plus some fermionic stuff. And these two models are known to have SO2C or SU2 current algebra symmetry which give us a very useful and strong instrument in order to actually solve these models. So in principle, indeed, at this Wessel-Minot point, at this particular point in the space of coupling constants, well, the theory is under full control because these two models are actually solved and the Firminec stuff is relatively easy to take care of in this example. So let's look a little bit at this, well, main non-trivial part. I mean, that's actually the hardest part to solve indeed. So here we're talking about the nonlinear conformal sigma model associated to hyperbolic free space. A common model for hyperbolic free space is to take the upper half space with this metric, where we have coordinates gamma, gamma bar for the complex plane, which sort of is on each level, I mean, which are the coordinates on the level surfaces for each value of the coordinate z, which gives the height over the plane. And the boundary of ADS3 in this picture is just then this plane parametrized by gamma and gamma bar. And if we use these coordinates, or rather go to exponential coordinates for this, well, I mean, replace z by exponential of phi, then we can figure out the Hamiltonian for this model, and it looks like this. So, okay, there's some standard Hamiltonian, I mean, free part. I mean, the whole point is here, this part is essentially free. There's a free, well, Hamiltonian for phi, and that's okay, essentially a beta gamma system for those who know of this. And that's the interesting part, which sort of contains the interacting nature of the sigma model, where you have this e to the 2 phi in front. Okay, that's reasonably simple. So what's the role of this term? Well, this becomes strong when we send phi to infinity, which corresponds to set to z going to infinity, which actually, when you map the upper half space, say, to the more standard picture of ADS3, say, as a solid cylinder where the boundary is just then the exterior, I mean, the hull of the cylinder. So this region, z going to infinity, then corresponds to the deep interior of ADS3. So this looks, or this acts like some exponential wall which enforces the regularity of the theory in the interior. So it just prevents strings from acquiring too large values of phi, thereby producing regularity in the interior. However, it disappears when you go to the boundary, which corresponds to phi going to minus infinity. That's the boundary in these coordinates. And this in particular, I mean, the disappearance of this term, which means that you're left just with some free field stuff in the worldsheet action, this leads to the phenomenon of long strings, which implies that in the, well, spectrum of the full string theory, you have a continuous part, namely strings, which asymptotically indeed reach the boundary. So there is, in fact, some cancellation between, well, the self-gravitation of the strings and some repulsive force from the antisymmetric tensor field on it, and this allows for strings reaching the boundary. Well, that's the long strings which appear there. But however, this is peculiar to the point of vanishing Ramon-Ramon background, where indeed the action is as described and you have the parent algebra symmetry at your disposal. If you now want to move away from this point, so if you want to go away from this double Wessel-Minot point, then you can also, of course, on the Lagrangian level, figure out the action or the Hamiltonian of the theory. And of course, it's well, there's a lot of junk. One interesting term is the following, which just comes from the fact that the sigma model part, I mean, you can view this perturbation as the perturbation of the Wessel-Minot-Witten Hamiltonian just by the sigma model Hamiltonian. And this Hamiltonian will contain in particular this term where you have e to the minus 2 phi, and then here the derivative, I mean, the primes are derivative with respect to the world sheet space coordinate, the space coordinate sigma. So this looks like a second wall, which, however, now has the opposite exponential than in the previous case. So now this wall, sort of, I mean, in quotation mark, instead shields the boundary instead of, well, shielding the interior, producing irregularity in the interior. So just from this fact, what you might expect is, so this means there's now a force which prevents the strings from reaching the boundary, so you expect that the continuous part of the spectrum disappears when you go away from the Western Minimum point or the vanishing Hamon point, and you end up with a purely discrete spectrum.
Okay, this of course still remains to be proven, but it pretty much looks like something like this should happen. And now, well, sometimes you may reasonably simplify life by just focusing on the radial motion, by which I mean the motion along the phi coordinate or the z coordinate. And in terms of the H3WZW model, it is known that if, for example, just you impose the constraint that pi gamma, the conjugate momentum to this coordinate gamma, equals to constant, then this H3WZW model reduces just to Liouville theory. I mean, essentially, you just replace in your interaction term here this prefactor by a constant, and that's the action that you get, where you just have a free real boson with, real boson with this exponential interaction term. An interesting remark in this context is that, well, indeed you can go backwards, and that's highly non-trivial that you can do this. You can actually reconstruct all of H3WZW model from Liouville theory. So these theories are related much closer than just, say, reduction procedure suggests. And now, okay, you may just have the idea that in order to mimic the effect of the second wall, you just add it to the Liouville action. Well, what you get is then here a cosine hyperbolic interaction term in the Lagrangian, so you're ending up with Sinch-Gordon theory. About this procedure, the important remark to be made is that also Liouville theory and Sinch-Gordon theory are known to be related quite intimately, in the sense that Liouville theory indeed is known to control the ultraviolet behavior of Sinch-Gordon theory, although in a somewhat intricate way, but there is a very direct and important relation between these theories. So let me summarize the picture which I want to put forward here about the relation between these theories in this table. So we have here on this side the theories with maximal chiral symmetry, which means current algebra symmetry or conformal symmetry here. So there we have Liouville theory and H3WZ and W model. The latter is embedded and represents the main non-trivial part in the PSL2/2WZW model, which is really the thing we want, at the Western Minimum point. Okay, and then you can go from Liouville to Sinch-Gordon by some deformation, essentially. And furthermore, you can go from WZ and W model to the, say, generic PSL2/2WZW model by some, presumably, and this also remains to be checked, by some marginal deformation. So, indeed, you can... Well, so the point I want to make here is really that all these theories are related to each other, in one way or another, so I think it makes sense to say that these represent a class of theories where you can expect, at least as far as integrable structures are concerned, to find some qualitative similarities or correspondences. Okay, I now jump into the Sinch-Gordon model, which is now hopefully motivated by the previous considerations. And well, I should start by saying that in some sense Sinch-Gordon model appears to be one of the simplest integrable models that you can think of at all. I mean, there's just a single particle, the factorized scattering matrix is known since a long time, the form factors are known since a long time. However, that's not quite the problem that would correspond to the problem that we need to solve for string theory. What we need there is the finite volume spectrum, and that's what is hard, and even for Sinch-Gordon, and until quite recently there was no systematic approach to this problem, and how one can approach it, that's precisely what I want to describe right now.
Well, as usual, or as often in quantum field theory, of course, one first has to get rid of the ultraviolet troubles. So one has to regularize ultraviolet divergences, and the standard way, or the successful way of doing it, is to look for lattice regularizations of the theory which preserve the classical integrability, and then one has a good hope or a good chance to really in the end take the continuum limit to get what one wants. Actually, it will be easier in our case than one might expect. Okay, so what's integrable lattice regularization in rather abstract terms for us? I mean, just to sort of set up some scheme here. It's a triple of things. There's a Hilbert space, the Hilbert space of our lattice theory. Of course, we need a Hamiltonian to describe the dynamics, which is supposed to be some discretization of the Sinch-Gordon Hamiltonian in continuous space. And then integrability is made manifest by the existence of a set of conserved charges which are supposed to be a permission to commute with each other, to commute with a Hamiltonian, and there ought to be sufficiently many of them in the following sense. Namely, if some operator commutes with all the conserved charges, then, in fact, it should be a function, well, which might be complicated, but anyway, just in the sense of, if you wish, functional calculus of self-adjoint operators, a function of the conserved charges. This says, I mean, another way of saying the same thing is that the eigenvalues of the full set of conserved charges parametrize an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian uniquely. Okay, so we start with a simple thing. We want to describe the Hilbert space of our model. And, well, to do this, we just discretize the Sinch-Gordon variables in the most standard way you can imagine. We're introducing some lattice spacing delta. Discretize the field by putting, well, by just taking the integer multiples of the lattice spacing, just considering the field at integer multiples of the lattice spacing, and something similar for the momentum. And the quantization is standard of these guys. So what this produces is a Hilbert space, which is L2 of R to the tensor power n. I mean, you have you have a periodic, say, chain, where on each side of your chain you're having one copy of L2 of R. That's all that we have. That's very simple. And then, well, the procedure to bring integrability into the game is the so-called quantum inverse scattering method, and there one proceeds in a somewhat inverted way, namely one constructs the conserved charges before one constructs the Hamiltonian. Of course, then, okay, one has to see if the Hamiltonian which commutes with the conserved charges is the one one wants, but anyway, it will work out in our case. Well, the procedure is as follows, and I just repeat, I just sketch sort of some standard material about quantum inverse scattering method. So the point is to introduce a lax connection on the lattice. So a connection which brings you from one lattice site to another, and then the key object to construct is the monodromy matrix, which is obtained by multiplying the lax connections along the lattice. And okay, there's a 2x2 matrix with operators as entries A, B, C, and D, it's rather one parameter families of operators depending on the spectral parameter. Now, okay, there's a little bit of art involved cooking up the correct form of a lax connection for the lattice model. So that's the thing which does the job in our case. What you find there are some functions here of our fundamental variables phi n, giving sort of the configuration space variable of our discretized Sinch-Gordon model, and the conjugate momentum variable phi n. And we're having two parameters here. One is the spectral parameter u on which this matrix depends. And with some hindsight, we're introducing another parameter s, which will be related to the Sinch-Gordon mass then in the end. And why does this give, commuting conserved charges? The basic observation to be made is that the commutation relations that pi n and phi n have with each other imply commutation relations for these matrix-valued
objects, monodromy matrix of the following form. So this, okay, is a rather condensed notation, which is standard to most, you know, where here you're having these 2x2 matrices. However, so here you're looking at some equation which takes place in the tensor product of the two-dimensional space C2 with itself, with entries being the operators here, which appear in the monodromy matrix. I mean, okay, to keep the story short, I mean, this is just a condensed way of writing the commutation relations of A, B, C, and D with each other, which are of quadratic nature, down in one single equation. And so what this implies is, in particular, of course, the commutation relations of the trace of the monodromy matrix with itself, and this turns out to be such that they commute with each other at different values of the spectral parameter U and V, which, if you expand the trace of the monodromy matrix into powers of e to the minus 2 pi bu, then okay, you're defining operators Tm, and these are mutually commuting with each other. So this is what gives us the set of conserved charges that we're about to study. Well, okay, the main non-trivial step then is to construct H such that, on the one hand, it commutes with the conserved charges we've just constructed, and secondly, in the end, it indeed represents a lattice discretization of the Sinch-Gordon Hamiltonian. And also, this is partially some standard, it is following some standard strategy from quantum inverse scattering method. However, there is one step which is quite non-trivial and quite non-standard, which is the construction of the main ingredient in this formula, this operator R. So, okay, let me just present you the result, and I really do not have the time to go into details about proofs and how then this is done. So the result is, okay, here in this formula, you have basically everything that you need. That's the construction of the Hamiltonian out of an operator R12, which is formed like this. You have a special function WB, which is a rather peculiar and interesting special function. This is the so-called non-compact quantum dye logarithm, and that you're having this particular choice of the special function is absolutely crucial, of course. And in particular, a remarkable feature of this function is that it is self-dual under replacement b going to b to the minus 1, which is directly related to the conjectured self-duality of Sinch-Gordon under the coupling constant beta going to 1 over beta. So, okay, there's this special function, and then you're cooking up a function of, then you're inserting into its argument here an operator S12. This is such that 4 times cosine hyperbolic of S12 is nothing but the Casimir of UQSL2R, the tensor product of two representations of UQSL2R, which are neither of highest nor of lowest weight type, but rather of principal series type. Okay, so this just gives you some flavor of what is behind the construction of this object, namely really representation theory of this quantum group, the non-compact quantum group, non-compact version of UQSL2. And that's essentially then also the tool that is, the mathematics that you need to use in order to prove the following results. Or you can write it as a sum over projectors. You're asking if it is sort of the standard form up to non-compact business, and the answer is yes. So you can write it via Clebsch-Gordon decomposition. So you just have to perform the spectral decomposition of this operator S12, which is the Clebsch-Gordon decomposition of the tensor product of two representations, in order to bring it to the form that you want, and that's precisely what we have used extensively here. Okay, and then there's cyclic shift operator, permutation operator, that's not so interesting. Yeah. Okay, and then the result about this Hamiltonian is that it is local. That's more or less trivial just from the form, how it is constructed as a derivative of a trace of products of
stuff which, when you set U to zero, it reproduces the permutation operator. So that's more or less standard. And what is highly non-standard and rather tedious to prove is then that this H commutes with the conserved charges that we have constructed. Okay, so we have constructed our triple H, H, and this curly Q. So we have conserved charges, Hamiltonian, and so on. So let's see if really this is what we want. I mean, at least to have a first hint. You can first take the classical limit and get something ugly. And then we can furthermore, with a result, take the continuum limit in a more or less standard fashion. So we send n to infinity, the number of lattice sites. We send the lattice spacing to zero with the length of the circle on which we work, the radius r, being fixed. And furthermore, we have to send this parameter s to infinity with this combination fixed. So that's the maybe more interesting part. So this introduces the Sinch-Gordon mass. Okay, and then the standard things. Well, indeed, if you work a little bit, I mean, it's not very hard to reproduce the Sinch-Gordon Hamiltonian density in this way. So indeed, it pretty much seems we're on the right track. So what do we have? The good news is we have succeeded in constructing an integrable lattice regularization of the Sinch-Gordon model. And if we just count the degrees of freedom, then we're led to the expectation that the spectral problem for H is indeed equivalent to the spectral problem to find the spectrum of the conserved charges, because we simply have enough of them in order to that we can hope that their eigenvalues indeed parametrize uniquely the states in the spectrum. But the bad news is that the algebraic beta that fails for this model, and okay, that's what I want to sketch why this is so. This is intimately related with the non-compactness that the target space of the Sinch-Gordon model has. Well, I probably will not be able to go through all the details. Let me just try to highlight the main ingredients in the following argument. The first argument is to, well, what we have to do is we have to construct the beta vacuum. And this is characterized by the condition that the off-diagonal part of the Lax operator should annihilate it. In this case, this is the condition, well, Ln 2-1 acting upside 0, the beta vacuum, with this being the formula for the off-diagonal part repeated, should be 0. But this implies the two condition e to the plus minus beta half phi n on psi 0 should be 0. Well, this is self-contradictory. This doesn't work at all. That's not a new point. I mean, the same thing has happened for Sinh-Gordon, where, say, putting I's in the exponential essentially is the way how to get Sinh-Gordon from our Sinch-Gordon model. So what has been proposed there is to consider the two-side Lax connection. So take the product of the Lax connections of two nearest neighbors. And okay, then you can figure out the form and a suggestive way, I mean, of this off-diagonal part of the Lax connection, which now is supposed to annihilate psi 0, the beta vacuum. Okay, you can write it in terms of generators for the quantum group UQSL2R in the representations I've mentioned, these representations of non-highest, non-lowest weight type. That's a representation, I mean, that defines a representation of the quantum group UQSL2R. And you can express it in terms of these generators. And there's a change of variables from the phi's and the pi's, the Sinch-Gordon variables, to variables xn, just for convenience. And then we can note that, okay, I mean, then we're having to solve these two conditions, that this operator should annihilate the beta vacuum and this operator should annihilate the beta vacuum. So we analyze these conditions and we observe that indeed, for example, this operator is unitarily equivalent to the co-product applied to E. And furthermore, with the help of the Clebsch-Gordon maps, I can bring this operator just to the exponential of 2 pi bx. I mean, now the operator x, which is related to the phi n, like this formula. So this means that the beta vacuum we're looking for is unitarily equivalent to the eigenvector of the operator e to the 2 pi bx with eigenvalue 0. That's the condition that we have to solve. mean, that's just a unitary equivalence, really. And such a state doesn't exist. I mean, it's not even in a distributional sense. So that's why the Betansatz fails in this context. And indeed, the reason is clearly the non-compactness, because you're having real exponentials here, which is related to having real exponentials in the interaction. And you're having real values for these pi and phi variables. So, well, indeed, it seems to come very naturally just from the fact that field variables are real and non-compact in Sinch-Gordon. Well, I should perhaps, well, let me just make another brief remark. Another sort of beta, and that's what one might try on this problem, is sort of, well, I think sometimes it's called coordinate beta and that. So, I mean, we could try to take advantage of the fact that the factorized scattering theory is known. So we have one massive particle. The scattering is just described by scattering phase in the two-body scattering, and the formula for that is known for a long time. And so then one could try to start from the ansatz for well-separated particles. I mean, the wave function for such a configuration one could try to describe as follows. So we're having just free motion, and well, this business just is tailored such that when two particles cross each other, then it is described via the scattering matrix. Fine. And okay, then if you impose periodic boundary conditions, what you get is quantization conditions of this form. So this could, I mean, you could also take as a starting point for describing the theory in finite volume, in particular to reduce its spectrum. However, what you should observe is, of course, that this ansatz for the wave function, which leads to this type of beta ansatz equations, is only valid if really the distances between particles are much larger than the inverse masses of the particles, because otherwise, I mean, you can simply not assume they're free, and you cannot neglect their interactions. And well, okay, so you... No, no, but if you have then at a finite distance, say, of the order of 1 over m, then you cannot make the ansatz that the wave function is going to be just a plane wave. That's usually... I mean, then you would start feeling the effects of particle creation, annihilation, and so on, all the standard business of relativistic quantum field theory. So really, you expect this form of the wave function to be only valid asymptotically when the particles are asymptotically far from each other, which is the case in particular in the limit where the length of the system goes to infinity, the thermodynamic limit. So indeed, this idea leads to the correct thermodynamic beta ansatz in Sinch-Gordon model, but it is not obvious that it gives some approach to the spectrum of Sinch-Gordon in the case of real finite volume. Well, okay, I mean, I have no mathematical proof that this is wrong, but I have a sort of systematic approach to the spectrum which gives results which, okay, at the moment have no relation whatsoever to this ansatz. And here, okay, I'm just pointing out that a priori you do not have a reason to trust this ansatz. So, Yeah, there's a huge difference to Sinch-Gordon in this case, because in Sinch-Gordon, in Sinch-Gordon model it seems to work much better for the reason that there you can boil down everything to the solitons. And the solitons are not, I mean, we have two of them, soliton, anti-soliton, and this leads to, in particular, a relation between the scattering matrix and then this R matrix which appears in the lattice discretization, etc., etc. So, again, that's one of the points I want to stress, that there are really important qualitative differences between these two cases from the point of view of integrable structure. Okay, so what can we do? And, well, the main sort of mathematical tool which allows to, I mean, which gives access to the finite volume spectrum of Sinch-Gordon model is the so-called Q operator, which then is found to satisfy the so-called Bext equation. So the main result, basically, that we can present here is that there exists a family of operators Q of U with the following properties. ultimately one of the most important is this equation here, a finite difference equation on this operator Q, which spits out T, the, say, generating function of the conserved charges on the left-hand side. So this tells that Q is indeed an object more fundamental than T, because if I have Q, I can just construct T from this equation. Okay, furthermore, it commutes with T at equal, say, arguments, at least. It commutes with itself at non-equal arguments. So again, this is a... you can view it as just another repackaging of all the conserved charges of your theory. Namely, it contains all the conserved charges in it, and whatever value you take will be a conserved charge of the model, and they all commute with each other for different values of the spectral parameter. Well, and furthermore, it's a normal operator, so it commutes with its adjoint, which ensures in particular existence of a spectral decomposition, so you can diagonalize it. The state? There's no state. I mean, that's an operator for the moment. It's just, it can be constructed. For example, here, that's the kernel which describes its this operator and the X representation and the Schrödinger representation for the model. So there's a kernel which, these guys, again, are just these quantum dilogarithms, non-compact quantum dilogarithms, again. So there's some, clearly, in order to prove all these properties, we need to have sufficiently explicit control. And there's a long story which I don't have the time to go into. I mean, this is really, of course, the key object to get the hands on in whenever, say, beta and that fails. And there is a lot of, say, representation theoretical structure which is behind its construction. So it is related to the R operator that we've seen before in some way. And this, in turn, is related to universal R matrix of UQSL2 hat in some way, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not quite a... there should be really some general scheme to produce these objects just essentially from group theory, but it is still to be developed really in full generality. So here the remark I just want to make is that just the existence of an operator with these properties plus something which I have to skip completely, discussion of separation of variables in this model, say some following the scheme of Sklianin, this leads to the refinement of the auxiliary spectral problem. I mean, simply because Q commutes with T or spits out T by the Spaxter equation, we can look for the eigenvalue problem of Q. And of course, then, if, as I suspected, already the eigenvalue of T is sufficient to parameterize eigenstates of the Hamiltonian uniquely, then of course the eigenvalue of Q which corresponds to it must be a function of this eigenvalue of T. So these must be related with each other. So simply this leads us to, instead of studying the eigenvalue problem for T, to study the eigenvalue problem for Q. Then these functions QT of U are essentially really what parametrizes our eigenvalues. So these, we have to find the whole set of functions QT of U which correspond to states in the spectrum. That's essentially now our exercise. That's the abstract reformulation of the problem to determine the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. I should furthermore mention, in particular, the corresponding eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian H can also be extracted from this eigenvalue Q of U in some way. So Q is just the generating function, of course, of the eigenvalues of all the conserved charges. So we have to find the possible values of this function QT of U. And what I'm writing down here is what I claim to be a complete set of conditions for the Lattice-Sinch-Gordon model which characterize the possible functions QT of U which can appear. Namely, the first is, QT of U has to satisfy the Baxter equation of this form. Well, A of U and D of U, I should have mentioned, these are known functions, some Sinch and so on. That's something explicitly known which is not so important for us here. So the Baxter equation is, of course, part of the conditions. Second, the other part of the conditions are conditions on analyticity and asymptotics of the solutions. So in particular, QT of U has to be meromorphic with a given set of poles. And finally, there is the asymptotic behavior has to be of a very particular type. In particular, they have to decay exponentially at infinity. And indeed, these properties are, for our model here, as good as usually beta ansatz is in other integrable models. So we can replace the function small qt of u by a function big qt of u by multiplying it with something known. Lorentz double gamma, that's not so important. It's just for convenience. We just want to kill the poles in order to have something which is anti-analytic. So then, this is just, I mean, the conditions 1, 2, 3 are reformulated as the conditions A and B, namely that these function big qt of u is anti-analytic of order 2. And secondly, that it satisfies some slightly modified Baxter equation. Well, from property A, we learn that indeed this function qt of u is uniquely characterized by its zeros, so we can expand it by some regularized product over its zeros of this form with some known calculable prefactor e to the r of u. And then we can plug this ansatz or this representation of qt of u back into the Baxter equation and just take the value where u takes the value of, I mean, where u is equal to one of the zeros uk. So then here the left-hand side disappears. We're left just with the right-hand side, which can be repackaged in this form. So this is some equations of beta ansatz type for the zeros. The big difference is that now, say, compared to the usual beta ansatz, we're having infinite products here. So to my mind, this is really sort of the characteristic feature of compact versus non-compact cases. Compact case having finite products, polynomial Q function, whereas here we're having non-polynomial dependence on the spectral parameter U. Well, so essentially sort of this result, which was called theorem 3, is basically as good as usually the derivation of beta ansatz equations is in other integrable models. Yeah, I should come to some end, and I will come to some end fairly soon. Next observation is that, okay, so far we were working on the lattice. However, in this representation, in terms of Q function and so on, and in terms of these conditions, these quantization conditions in terms of Baxter equation and asymptotics analyticity, turns out to be fairly easy to take the continuum limit. I mean, you just do it and define the conditions for the continuum Sinch-Gordon model, which are claimed to describe uniquely, or I mean, which are claimed to characterize completely the spectrum of continuum Sinch-Gordon model in finite volume. Well, these are these conditions. It's anti-analytic. The poles move out to infinity in the continuum limit. Decays rapidly at infinity. Satisfies the simplified version of the Baxter equation. In fact, these coefficients just become unity in this case. And finally, there's another condition one can derive, which is sort of probably, I mean, let me just mention it in passing for the experts. It's a so-called quantum Wronskian condition, which I believe will be quite useful if one further wants to study and evaluate these conditions. So that is related to the Baxter equation in some way, but okay, I think this can be sometimes much more useful as a starting point. So okay, this is a abstract characterization of the spectrum, again basically as good as beta ansatz is in other integrable models. And in order to get a slightly better feeling that we have achieved something useful, let us consider just the function Q0 of U, which corresponds to the ground state. So far, I've written down conditions which are claimed to characterize the spectrum, generic states in the spectrum. Now we want to focus on the special state, namely the ground state. So we have to add a condition which singles out the ground state among the generic states. And the conjecture that one can make, which ultimately should be proven just by careful analysis of what we had seen before, but for the moment it's just a conjecture, is that the condition we have to add is simply this one, namely that Q0 of U is just non-vanishing in a certain strip. Well, and then comes a little piece of magic, at least if you have not done these manipulations yourself before. The claim is these conditions, 1, 2, 5, determine this function Q0 of U uniquely. And, the answer is as follows. This is the formula for Q0 of U in terms of the function Y of U, which is nothing but the solution to an nonlinear integral equation of this form. Okay, so you can go ahead, put this on a computer. In fact, it usually can be solved rather efficiently with numerics, these integral equations of this type. And then from this you calculate Q0 of U, and what you also calculate from it is, for example, the whole set of values of all the conserved charges in the ground state. I mean, that's nothing but what is contained in Q0 of U. Remark for the experts, of course, this equation is sort of well known. This appears in the TDA for the Sinch-Gordon model, where here the kernel which appears is the scattering matrix. However, we have arrived at this formula without ever talking about TDA or having even the slightest idea about how TDA comes about. We have just found it by mathematically reformulating these conditions 1, 2, 5. It's just a mathematical equivalence that these abstract conditions on Baxter equation as analyticity and asymptotics combined with this condition imply this rather concrete description of Q0 of U. So, and furthermore, really what I should stress here is at this point I'm almost done. At this point we also show that the Sinch-Gordon theory, which we describe in these rather abstract terms by starting from the lattice model and passing to continuum limit, is really the one which usually is studied. Namely, with TBA, for example, we can calculate the ground state energy for arbitrary radius of the spatial circle. And, this result, which I've shown here, is that this result is reproduced exactly from separation of variables, Q operators, and so on. But now we have much more. Namely, we have the full Q function, and we have thereby all the other conserved charges in the ground state as well. And in particular, we even have more than that. Namely, we have a characterization of generic states and not just the ground state. Okay, so concluding remarks. What we have found here, what I've shown is, we have the first decent integrable lattice regularization of the Sinch-Gordon model. Maybe a remark I could or should make here is that the fact that we have these funny representations of a non-compact quantum group is crucial for having, for example, self-adjointness of all the conserved charges manifest all over the way. So that's why it is rather useful and technically rather manageable. Algebraic beta and that fails. I have explained why. And really the remark I want to make is that I believe that the integrable models with non-compact targets and exponential interactions, to my mind, they represent a new class of integrable models which have not so much been studied so far. Of course, concerning scattering and so on, that's a lot known. So my prediction, which is maybe a bit bold at this point, is that beta ansatz will also fail for all the other members in this class, which, as I argued, contains models like these ones. We can discuss. That's a little provocative, of course, but I present it here as a prediction, and you can prove me wrong. But we can do better than that. There is separation of variables. There is some machinery that we can apply. We did a little bit on clarifying the separation of variables method in our work, but that's not what I discussed here. Quantization conditions can be translated into Baxter equation plus analyticity plus asymptotics, and furthermore, in this framework, the continuum limit was quite easy. Thanks.
Questions?
Yeah.
Could you explain how this relates to your work?
Not really. He started directly. I explain why. He started directly in the continuum theory, and many of his manipulations look quite formal because he really simply didn't bother much about ultraviolet problems and so on. I think, okay, that's as far as my understanding of his work goes, more or less. So. No, he didn't go that far. No, no, I mean, this is a new result. I mean, this would not come before.
Okay, so as far as I understand, the algebraic beta ansatz is based on a ground state, or you can say it's based on highest or lowest weight representations. Mm-hmm. Whereas here you're dealing with something which is not the highest or lowest weight representation.
Right.
So is that simply, could you just summarize the problem as that?
Yeah, I think that's a rather useful point of view, that indeed sort of it is very natural in the non-compact context that also the beta ansatz, which is sort of the highest weight construction, of course, of the eigenstates, starting from highest weights vector, is replaced by something where one should not use highest or lowest weight states, but rather has to deal with representations which don't have highest or lowest weight. So I think from the representation theoretical point of view, it is very natural to have in this non-compact context.
Well, I mean, certainly in the compact groups, you have highest and lowest weight representations
yes.
at the same time. That's why they're finite. But in the non-compact groups, you can have highest weight representations, or you can have these continuous representations.
Right.
At least in gauge theory and at least in perturbation theory, we're dealing with a highest weight representation.
Yes.
That's why, at least to some extent, we make use of.
Yeah, okay, there's some intermediate case. Of course, you can have only highest weight representations in a non-compact context,
yeah.
In which case the structure is still pretty much algebraic and pretty close to the compact case.
Yeah.
You would start finding features like those as soon as you feel forced to combine highest and lowest weight representations, say, in a staggered manner.
Oh.
But
what determines the representation you put on the spin sheet?
That's a unsolved question. I think, I mean, that's an old question. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a general recipe, sort of, which tells you which representation is the good one. You have to try something, work it through, and then at some points, for example, discover that the Hamiltonian turns out to be the right one, or you make some other contact with some independent quantization scheme. Otherwise,
is what you use
for
the what did you use for the last result? What did you take this
one? For the last result, you mean this one? Or?
I mean, you got some community.
Yeah. So, this
you
was.
You need to start with some spin, I guess.
Right, okay, the spins, which is, I mean, the S was also the Casimir of the quantum group representation, of course. This is sent to infinity in a matter which introduces, in a manner which introduces the mass. So, S is traded for the mass, and then.
Yeah, so other questions?
Have you seen what happens? Since in Sine-Gordon, the finite volume nonlinear integral equations are well known, have you seen if you write down the equation for the breeder and forget about the solitons in Sine-Gordon, make just a formal transformation of the beta of the parameter? And so you should be able to get the TBA equation somehow, or Y. And have you seen what happens to the Q operator in that case, in which everything is on a solid base? Also because in the end, I think your T of your analytic, of the Baxter analytic beta ansatz should be the transformatics of the monodromy mass you introduced in the quantum mean scattering, I think. The trace of the monodromy mass.
So
there is no way to the past. So much from the quantum mean scattering.
This is quantum mean scattering, just sort of generalized slightly to the non-compact context. Otherwise, you
just move the attention from the T to the Q somehow.
That's right.
Is that right?
So that sort of shift of attention, which I sort of would like to advertise as probably being rather fruitful for the future development of the subject. And the Q is indeed. I mean, it contains. Well, in some sense, strictly speaking, it doesn't contain more, but it seems to contain the information on conserved charges and so on in a more useful form. something.
Yes, but what I was pointing out is that maybe you may get, I don't know if you looked at it, I have...
You mean the comparison with Sine-Gordon was...
With the Bredon, not the soliton equation.
Yeah.
Which is not a direct derivation from the Bethe answer. You have to manipulate a little bit the solid, say that the... because it's an excited state somehow.
I mean, frankly, I didn't make this comparison in detail yet. It is very certainly it's very interesting to do that, because it is known, of course, that certain quantities do continue essentially analytically from Sine-Gordon to Sinch-Gordon, but there's other stuff which does not which does not seem to continue at all. In particular, for example, technically one way to extract local conserved charges of Sinch-Gordon is to look at the expansion of Q function for spectral parameter going to infinity. In Sine-Gordon case, you find both local and non-local conserved charges in such expansions. Non-local conserved charges being associated to the solitons. In the Sinch-Gordon case, you do not find any contributions from non-local conserved charges, which Lukyanov has interpreted as just being related to the absence of solitons in Sinch-Gordon. So there are, even in the analytic structure of the Q function, profound differences, and so on the level of Q function, you do not expect a simple continuation to hold. Definitely not. So even... the story is not completely understood at this point, so I cannot really answer your question satisfactorily. Okay. So that's what I can say.
Maybe a last question.
Sinch-Gordon has rather simple form factors. I would expect that it is also an interesting candidate for studying, say, correlation functions directly, from your construction. Sure. The first thing one should maybe do is to express the local fields in terms of the monodomain matrix elements.
Yeah,
can you do that?
At the moment I can, but of course that's on the agenda. Sure, I mean, that's all very interesting future directions for this. I mean, that's, you see, it's pretty much in some stage of infancy. We just arrived at sort of the beta ansatz in some way, and of course this has to be analyzed more, and correlation functions and so on, all this. That's a lot.
Maybe just one comment. I think what we have in string theory is still very different from this model, because it seems that in your case the Poisson structure of the classical L operators is ultra-local. Is it true?
That's right.
Then you have a nice method of Baxter operator and so on. This is not the case what we have in string theory.
Yeah, but you would have the same story in Wesson and Witten case, even at the conformal point. So something at the, I mean, I know H3WZW is related to Liouville theory, and from the integrable point of view, it is this quantum group which is then giving good lattice discretizations of this. So this for me is some indication that also from the integrable point of view, this sort of structures are not so far from what one would need there. But how this comes about in detail really is something which would be very important to understand.
Yeah, okay, maybe you can ask more questions on the boat this evening. So let's thank Jürg.
Yeah, that's a little bit.